ads in the back of Playboy and Hustler. When he added seminars to his repertoire, he began marketing on the internet as well. One of his students, a legendary computer hacker named Louis DePain, soon created the news group alt.seduction.fast. Out of that forum, an international cabal of PUAs gradually came into being. "When I first came out with this stuff, I was savagely ridiculed," Ross said. "I was called every name in the book and accused of the worst things. I was really angry for a while, very pissed off. But gradually, the argument went from, is this real, to, should they be doing it?" And that is why every guru owes at least a pledge of allegiance to Ross Jeffries. He laid the groundwork. It's also why every time new teachers pop up, Ross tries to shoot them down. In a few cases, he has even threatened to reveal a young competitor's online seduction activities to his parents or school administration. Worse than mystery, in his mind, was a former speed seduction student named David D'Angelo. Originally, D'Angelo called himself Sisonif, which is hypnosis spelled backward, and worked his way into the speed seduction hierarchy, where he helped Ross with marketing. But the two of them had a falling out when Ross supposedly hypnotized a girlfriend of D'Angelo's into having sex with him. According to Ross, D'Angelo had brought the girl to him to seduce. It wasn't uncommon, he said, for students to bring him women as a sacrifice of sorts. According to D'Angelo, Ross was in no way given permission to touch the girl. Whatever the case, the result was that the two stopped speaking, and D'Angelo set up a rival business called Double Your Dating. It was based not on NLP or any other form of hypnosis, but rather on evolutionary psychology and D'Angelo's principle of cocky funny. "You know, my cheap jack imitator, David the Anus Hole, is having his first seminar in L.A. this weekend," Ross said. "The guy is so fucking good-looking and well-connected in the nightclub scene, it just astounds me that people think he could ever understand their situation and the difficulties they encounter in dealing with women. I made a mental note to sign up for the seminar. There's a certain view of women that David the Anus Hole and Gun Bitch and Misery have," Ross continued, working himself into a rage. "These guys are focusing on the worst tendencies of some of the worst women out there and spreading it like a cloud of fertilizer on all women." Ross reminded me of an old rhythm and blues artist who has been ripped off so much that he trusts no one. But at least there are publishing companies and copyrights in place to protect songwriters. There is no way to copyright a woman's arousal, to declare certain authorship over her choice of a partner. His paranoia, sadly, made sense. Especially when it came to Mystery, the only seducer with the ideas and skills to supplant him. The waiter cleared our pasta. "I am so passionate about this because I care about these kids," Ross was saying. "I think that 20% of my students have been abused. They have been severely impacted. Not just with women, but with all people, male and female. And a lot of problems in society come from the fact that we all have such strong drives, but live in a culture that discourages us from exploring them freely." He turned around and noticed three businesswomen eating dessert a few tables away. He was about to freely explore his sex drive. "How's that berry cobbler?" Ross yelled at them. "Oh, it's good," one of the women replied. "You know," Ross said to them, "people have signal systems for dessert." He was off and running. The signals say, "This is sugar-free, this melts in my mouth," and the signal system fires up your body's responsiveness to get ready for what comes next. It's tracing an energy flow through your body. He had the women's attention now. "Really?" they asked. "I teach courses in energy flow," Ross told them. The women oohed in unison. The word energy is the equivalent of the smell of chocolate to women in Southern California. "We were just talking about whether men really understand women, and we think we've figured it out." In a flash, he was at their table. As he spoke, the women forgot completely about their dessert and stared at him rapt. "I couldn't tell sometimes if his patterns really worked on the sophisticated subconscious level he claimed, or if most conversations were so boring that simply saying something different and intriguing was enough to trigger attraction." "Oh my God," one of the women said when he finished running a pattern about the qualities women look for in a man. "I've never heard it said like that before. Where do you teach? I'd love to know more." Ross collected her phone number and returned to the table. He turned to me, smiled, and said, "Now do you see who's teaching the true way?" Then he rubbed his thumb on his chin. Chapter 3. Attraction isn't a choice. Those were the words David D'Angelo had projected on the wall. The seminar was packed. There were more than 150 people in the room. Many of them I recognized from other seminars, including Extramask. It was getting to be an all too familiar sight. A person on stage with a headset instructing a group of needy men on how to save themselves from nightly onanism. But there was a difference. D'Angelo was a good-looking guy, like Ross Jeffries had said. He reminded me of Robert De Niro, if De Niro had been a mama's boy who'd never been in a fight in his life. D'Angelo stood out from the other gurus precisely because he didn't stand out. He wasn't charismatic or interesting. He didn't have the crazy gleam of a wannabe cult leader or some gaping hole in his soul that he was trying to fill with women. He didn't even claim to be good at the game. He was very ordinary, but he was dangerous because he was organized. He had clearly spent months working on his seminar. It was not only entirely scripted, but cleaned up for mass consumption. It was a school of pickup instruction that could be presented to the mainstream without shocking anyone with its crudeness, its attitude toward women, or the deviousness of its techniques. Except, that is, for his recommendation of reading the book Dog Training by Lou Burke for tips on handling girls. D'Angelo was a bright guy and a threat to Ross. Many of the speakers at his seminar were, like himself, Ross's former students. Among them, Rick H., Vision, and Orion, an uber nerd who was famous as the first PUA to sell videotapes of himself approaching girls on the street. This video series, Magical Connections, was considered hard evidence that nerds with hypnosis skills could get laid. Seduction, D'Angelo read from his notes, is defined in the dictionary as an enticement to wrongdoing, specifically the offense of inducing a woman to consent to unlawful sexual intercourse by enticements which overcome her scruples. In other words, he continued, seduction implies tricking, being dishonest, and hiding your motives. That is not what I am teaching. I'm teaching something called attraction. Attraction is working on yourself and improving yourself to the point where women are magnetically attracted to you and want to be around you. Not once did D'Angelo mention the names of his competitors and rivals. He was too smart for that. He was going to try to take this whole underground world up for air, and he was going to do it by not acknowledging the underground world at all. He had stopped posting online, and instead hired others to stick up for him when he was flamed. He wasn't a genius or an innovator like Mystery and Ross, but he was a great marketer. "How do you make someone want something?" he asked, after making his students practice giving each other James Dean underlooks. "You give it value. You show that others like it. You make it scarce, and you make them work for it. I want you to think about other ways during lunch." I joined D'Angelo and some of his other students for a burger and found out a little more about him. A struggling real estate agent from Eugene, Oregon, he moved to San Diego for a fresh start. Lonely, he yearned to cross that invisible barrier separating two strangers at a club. So he began searching the web for tips and cultivating friends who were good with women. One of those friends was Riker, a Ross Jeffries protege who turned him on to using America Online to meet women. Sending instant messages was a way for D'Angelo to practice flirting the way his new player friends did, but without risking public embarrassment. "That was the chi," he said, as students milled about awkwardly, trying to overhear. "I was learning new ideas, implementing them, and then noticing how women responded on America Online. That's when I learned that busting women's balls and really slamming them immediately didn't have the effect that the intuitive mind would guess it would. So I became cocky and funny. I stole their lines, I teased them, I accused them of hitting on me, and I never gave them a break." Flush with his new findings, D'Angelo delivered a 15-page screed to Cliff's List, one of the oldest and most established online seduction newsletters. The then-nascent seduction community ate it up. A new guru had arrived. Cliff, the middle-aged Canadian businessman who ran the list by day and hunted for new master puas to bring into the community by night, helped convince D'Angelo to spend 3 weeks turning his manifesto into an ebook, Double Your Dating. The highlight of the seminar was an appearance by two people who would give me my much-coveted inner game and more, Steve P. and Rasputin. These were guys I'd heard whispered about in the seduction community since I'd joined, the true masters, leaders of women, not men. The first thing they did when they walked on stage was hypnotize everybody in the room. They both talked at the same time, telling different stories, one to occupy the conscious mind and the other to penetrate to the subconscious. When they woke us up, we had no idea what they had installed in our heads. All we knew was that these were two of the most confident speakers we'd ever seen. Every ounce of fire and charisma that D'Angelo lacked, they possessed in bulk. Wearing a leather vest and an Indiana Jones hat, Steve P. was equal parts Hell's Angel and Native American shaman. Rasputin was a strip club bouncer with mutton chop sideburns who looked like a steroid-jacked Wolverine. The two had met in a bookstore while both reaching for the same NLP book. Now they worked as a team and were among the most powerful hypnotists in the world. Their advice on seducing women was simply, become an expert in how to feel good. Toward that end, Steve P. had figured out a way to get women to pay to have sex with him. For anywhere from several hundred to $1,000, he trained women to have orgasms from a single vocal command. He taught them three different stages of deep throat he had devised, and most fantastically, he claimed to give hypnotic breast enlargements, which he said could make a woman jump as much as two cup sizes. Rasputin's forte was what he called hypnotic sexual engineering. Sex, he explained, must be viewed as a privilege for the woman, not a favor to you. If a woman wants to give me a blowjob, he elaborated, I tell her, you only get three sucks, and you may only go down as far as you receive pleasure. His chest stuck out like the top of a Volkswagen. Afterward, I tell her, didn't that feel nice? Next time you get five sucks. Afterward, D'Angelo introduced me to the pair. The top of my head came up to Rasputin's Volkswagen. I'd love to learn more about what you do, I said. You're nervous, Rasputin said. Well, you two are a little intimidating. Let me get rid of that anxiety, Steve offered. Tell me your phone number backward. I started saying 5, 4, 9, 6. As I did, Steve snapped his fingers. Okay, take a deep breath and now blow out hard, he commanded. As I did, Steve traced his fingers up from my navel and made a whooshing sound. Be gone, he commanded. Now watch that feeling just blow away like a smoke ring on a windy day. Notice how it's gone. It's no more. Take a tour of your body and try and find where it was, and notice how there's a different vibration there. Okay, open your eyes. Try really hard to bring any piece of it back. See? You can't. I couldn't tell whether it had worked or not, but I was reeling. He'd definitely taken my mind and body on some kind of one-minute trip. He took a step back and scanned my face, as if reading a diary. A guy named Phoenix offered to pay me $2,000 to follow me around for 3 days, Steve P. said. And I told him no, because he wants to make women his slaves. You seem like you may care about women. You don't just want to stuff your meat bat in some hole. You're willing to explore shit. Suddenly, we heard a commotion behind us. Two sisters and their mother had made the mistake of walking down a hallway full of pickup artists, and the vultures were descending on the carrion. Orion, the Uber nerd, was reading one of the girls' palms. Rick H. was telling the mother that he was Orion's manager. Grimble was moving in on the remaining girl, and a crowd of wannabe puas had gathered around, trying to see the masters at work. Listen, Steve P. said in a rush. Here's my card. Call me if you ever want to learn some inner circle shit. I'd love to. But this is classified, he warned. If we let you in, you cannot share these techniques with anybody. They're very powerful, and in the wrong hands, they could really screw a girl up. Got it, I said. He twisted a piece of white paper in his hand into the shape of a rose, then bounded off in the direction of the carrion. He approached the girl Grimble was sarging, told her to smell the flower, and within 30 seconds, she was passed out in Steve's arms. This was inner circle shit, and I was about to learn it. Chapter 4. And so began the weirdest phase of my education. Every weekend, I drive 2 hours south to San Diego and stay at Steve P.'s small, squalid apartment, where he raised two sons the same way he talked to his students, with compassionate obscenity. His 13-year-old was already a better hypnotist than I would ever be. In the afternoons, Steve and I drove to see Rasputin. They'd sit me in a chair and ask what I wanted to learn. I had a list. To believe that I was attractive to women, to live in my own reality, to stop worrying about what other people thought of me, to move and speak with an air of strength, confidence, mystery, and depth, to get over my fear of sexual rejection, and, of course, to attain a sense of worthiness, which Rasputin defined as the belief that one deserves the best the world has to offer. It was easy to memorize routines, but mastering inner game after a lifetime of bad habits and thought patterns was not easy. These guys, however, had the tools to fix me in time for Mystery's next workshop in Miami. "We're going to reframe you to where you're not glad to have some boopsie sucking your dick," Steve explained. "It will be a privilege for her to get to drink from the nectar of the master." At each session, they'd put me under, and Rasputin would tell complex metaphorical stories into one of my ears, as Steve P. issued commands to my subconscious in the other ear. They'd leave open loops, or unfinished metaphors and stories, in my mind that they'd close a week later. They'd play music designed to elicit specific psychological reactions. They'd put me into trances so deep that hours went by in the blink of an eye. Afterward, I'd go back to Steve's house and read his NLP books while he screamed at his kids. I have a theory that most naturals, like Dustin, lose their virginity at a young age and consequently never feel a sense of urgency, curiosity, and intimidation around women during their critical pubescent years. Those who must learn to meet women methodically, on the other hand, like myself and most students in the community, generally suffer through high school without girlfriends or even dates. Thus, we're forced to spend years feeling intimidated by and alienated from women who hold in their sole possession the key to releasing us from the stigma blighting our young adult lives, our virginity. Steve fit in with my theory on naturals. He was initiated into sex when he was in first grade. An older girl wanted to give him a blowjob. He responded by trying to hit her with a rock. But eventually she convinced him, and the experience set off a lifelong obsession with oral sex. When he was 17, he said, a cousin hired him to work in the kitchen of a Catholic girls' school. After he gave oral sex to one of the girls, word spread, and he soon became the sexual go-to guy on campus. In addition to giving the girls pleasure, however, he also gave them guilt. And after a few too many confessions that involved the boy in the kitchen, Steve was fired. He ran with a bike gang for a while, but left soon after accidentally shooting a guy in the nuts. He now devoted his life to a self-styled mix of sexuality and spirituality. And for all his crude talk, he was at heart a good person. Unlike many of the other gurus I'd met, I trusted him. When Steve's kids went to sleep each night, he taught me inner circle magic he'd learned from shamans whose names he'd sworn never to pronounce. The first weekend I stayed over, he gave me a lesson in soul gazing, which is when you look deep into a woman's right eye with your own right eye as you breathe together. "Once you do this with her, she's going to bond real strong with you," he warned. His cautionary speeches were often longer than the actual teaching process. "When you do this, you become Anamkara, which in Gaelic means friend of the soul. A soul friend." The following weekend, I learned about menage a trois management and how to train a woman to eat another woman's pussy by having her put a dried nectarine in her mouth and chew erotically on it during sex. The next weekend, he showed me how to throw chi through my hands into a woman's abdomen. And the next weekend, he taught me to contain and cycle orgasmic energy so that a woman can stack one withheld orgasm on top of another. Until, as Steve P. put it, she's shaking like a dog shitting peach seeds. Finally, he shared what he considered to be his greatest skill, guiding any woman through words and touch to a powerful orgasm that gushes like Niagara Falls. This was a whole new level of game. He was giving me superpowers. I was in a whirlwind of learning. I didn't call my friends. I barely talked to my family. I turned down every writing assignment that came my way. I was living in an alternate reality. "I told Rasputin," Steve said one night, "that more than all the other seduction boys out there, I'd like you to become one of our trainers." It was an offer I'd have to turn down. The seduction world was a palace of open doors. Walking through one, no matter how tempting the treasures inside, would mean having to shut the rest. Besides, by this point, I'd realized something. I didn't need to meet any more gurus. I had every piece of information I needed to become the greatest pickup artist in the world. I had hundreds of openers, routines, cocky funny comments, ways to demonstrate value, and powerful sexual techniques. and I'd been hypnotized to Valhalla and back. It wasn't necessary to learn anything else, unless it was for my own fun and interest. I just needed to be in the field constantly, approaching, calibrating, fine-tuning, and working through my sticking points. I was ready for Miami and all the workshops to follow. As I drove home from Steve P's house for the last time, I made a promise to myself. If I ever met a guru again, it would be not as a student, but as an equal. Step 5. Isolate the target. Chapter 1. As Mystery and I traveled the world doing workshops, meeting all the players in the game, the seduction community became more than just a bunch of anonymous screen names. It became a flesh-and-blood family. Mad Dash was no longer seven letters of type, but a funny, Jeremy Piven-like entrepreneur from Chicago. Stripped was an uptight book editor from Amsterdam with male model looks. Nightlight 9 was a lovable nerd who worked for Microsoft. Over time, the posers and keyboard jockeys were outed, and the superstars were given their due. And Mystery and I were the superstars, because we delivered. Miami, Los Angeles, New York, Toronto, Montreal, San Francisco, and Chicago. Every workshop made us better, stronger, more driven. All the other gurus I had met clung to the safety of the seminar room. They had never been forced to prove their teachings in the field, city after city, night after night, woman after woman. Every time we left a city, a lair sprung up if one didn't exist already, bringing together students eager to practice their new skills. Through word of mouth, the lair soon doubled, tripled, and quadrupled in size. And all these guys worshipped Mystery and style. We were living the life they wanted, or so they thought. Each workshop generated more online reviews, praising my newly acquired game. Each field report I posted triggered a flood of emails from students wanting to be my wing. The list of sergers in my phone book was actually starting to surpass the number of girls I'd met. Most of the time, when my phone rang, it was a guy asking for style. And, dispensing with introductions, he'd ask, "When you call a girl, should you block your number or not?" Or, "I was in a three set, and the obstacle ended up liking me and giving me her phone number. Do I still have a chance with the target?" Since I'd started spending so much time with PUAs, I'd lowered my standards for people I hung out with. All my old friends had fallen by the wayside. Now my social life was monopolized by a caliber of nerd I'd never associated with before. But it was worth it, because it was part of the process of becoming that guy in the club. The one I'd always envied. The one in the corner making out with a girl he'd just met. The Dustin. Before I discovered the community, the only time I'd ever made out with a girl I met in a club was when I first arrived in Los Angeles. But in the middle of kissing, she pulled away and said, "Everyone must think you're a producer or something." The subtext was that she was otherwise too hot to be making out with a slob like myself. It shattered me for months. I was too insecure to handle what was, in retrospect, her own form of neg. But now, when I walked into a club, I felt a rush of power, wondering which woman would have her tongue down my throat within half an hour. For all the self-improvement books I'd read, I still wasn't above shallow validation seeking. None of us were. That's why we were in the game. Sex wasn't about getting our rocks off. It was about being accepted. Mystery, in the meantime, had gone through his own metamorphosis during our travels. He had developed a radical new form of peacocking. It was no longer enough to wear just one item to catch the attention of the opposite sex. Now, all his items were larger than life, turning Mystery himself into a mobile sideshow. He wore 6-inch platform boots and a bright red tiger-striped cowboy hat, which combined to make him 7 feet tall. He added skin-tight black PVC pants, futuristic goggles, a plastic-spiked backpack, a mesh see-through shirt, black eyeliner, white eyeshadow, and as many as 7 watches on his wrists. Every head turned as he walked down the street. He didn't need openers. The women opened him. Girls followed him for blocks. Some grabbed his ass. One older woman even bit his crotch. And all he had to do if he was interested was perform a few magic tricks, which seemed to justify his outlandishness. His new look also served as a great litmus test for women. It repelled the type of girl he wasn't interested in and attracted the type he was. "I'm dressing for the outrageous club girls, the hot slutty girls, the ones I could never get," he explained one night when I accused him of looking like a clown. "They're playing groupie, so I gotta play rockstar." Mystery constantly encouraged me to dress as outlandishly as he did. Though I buckled one afternoon and bought a purple fur vest in a Montreal lingerie shop, I didn't get off on the constant gawking and attention. Besides, I was doing well enough without it. My reputation stemmed largely from the Miami workshop, where in a period of 30 minutes, I put my previous 6 weeks of hypnosis, training, and guru chasing into action. It was a night that would go down in the annals of community history. It was seduction not as wrestling, but as ballet, a perfect example of form. It was the night of my official graduation from AFC to PUA. Chapter 2. It was the perfect Sarge. When they walked into the VIP area of Miami's Crow Bar, everyone noticed. They were both platinum blondes with well-tanned fake breasts and identical outfits, tight white tank tops and tight white pants. How could anyone not notice? They were what most PUAs would call perfect tens, and they were dressed to turn men into beasts. This was South Beach, where testosterone levels run high, and the pair had been whistled and hollered at all night. The girls seemed to enjoy the attention almost as much as they savored shooting down the men who gave it to them. I knew what to do, and that was to do what everyone else wasn't doing. A pickup artist must be the exception to the rule. I had to suppress every evolutionary instinct inside me and pay them no attention whatsoever. With me were Mystery and two of our students, Outbreak and the Matador of Love. The rest of our pupils were sarging on the perimeter of the dance floor downstairs. Outbreak went in first, complimenting the platinum twins on their outfits. They brushed him off like a gnat. Next, the Matador of Love moved in with the Maury Povich opener. He too crashed and burned. Now it was my turn. This was going to take every bit of confidence and self-esteem that Steve P. and Rasputin had hypnotized into me. If I showed even a flicker of weakness or doubt, they'd eat me alive. "That tall one isn't a 10, Mystery leaned in and whispered to me. "She's an 11. This is going to take some hardcore negging." The girls strolled to the bar, where they began talking to a transvestite in a black tutu. I moved in, not even glancing at them, and greeted the transvestite as if I knew him. I asked if he worked at the club, and he said no. It didn't really matter what I said to him. I was just maneuvering into position, pawning him for the two-set. Now that I was in range, it was time to neg. "That girl over there is biting your style," I said to the 10, the shorter of the two. "Look at her." I pointed to another platinum blonde in a white outfit. "She's just got the same hair," the 10 replied, dismissively. "No, look at her outfit," I persisted. "It's almost the exact same." They looked over, and here was the make-or-break moment. If I didn't come up with something good to follow, I'd lose their interest and be branded just another weirdo. So I continued with the negging. "You know what?" I told them. "You both look like strange little snowflakes." It was a bizarre, cryptic comment, but now I had their attention. I could sense it, and my heart began to pump faster. I continued with what I knew all along would be my true opener. "I have to ask you something. Is your hair real?" The 10 looked shocked, then recovered her composure. "Yes," she said, "feel it." I pulled it gently. "Hey, it moved. It's not real." "Pull harder." I complied and yanked it so hard that her neck jerked back. "Okay," I said. "I believe you. But how about your friend there?" The 11's face reddened. She leaned over the bar and looked me hard in the eye. "That is really rude. What if I'm bald underneath here? That could really hurt someone's feelings. It's disrespectful. How would you feel if someone said that to you?" The pickup is a high-stakes game, and to win, you have to play hard. All I had done so far was commandeer their attention and provoke an emotional reaction. Sure, it was a negative one, but now we had a relationship. If I could turn her anger around, I'd be in. Fortunately, I happened to be trying to make a point to the students and was wearing a black mod wig and a fake lip piercing, just to show that looks don't matter. It's all game. I leaned over the bar and stared the 11 down. "Well," I told her, "I actually am wearing a wig, and I am bald underneath here." I paused, and she looked at me with her mouth open. She didn't know how to respond. Now it was time to reel her in. "And I'll tell you something else. Whether I go out totally bald in this wig or in some crazy long-haired wig, it doesn't change the way I'm treated by other people. It's all your attitude. Don't you agree? Everything I say in a pickup has an ulterior motive. I needed to let her know that, unlike every other guy in the bar, I am not and will not be intimidated by her looks. Beauty to me now was a shit test. It weeded out the losers who got dumbstruck by it. I live in Los Angeles, I continued. It's where the most beautiful women in the country come to try and make it. You look around a club there, and everyone's good-looking. It makes this VIP room look like a dive bar. They were words I'd learned almost verbatim from Ross Jeffries, and they were working. I let her look around, then continued. And do you know what I've learned? Beauty is common. It's something you're born with or you pay for. What counts is what you make of yourself. What counts is a great outlook and a great personality. Now I was in. It was the girls who were dumbstruck now, not me. I had entered their world, as Jeffries once put it to me, and demonstrated authority over it. And, to ensure my position there, I threw in one more neg, but softened with a slight compliment, as if they were winning me over. And you know what? You have a great smile. I can tell that underneath all that, you're probably a good person. The 10 sidled up to me and said, "We're sisters." A lesser pickup artist would have thought that his work was done, that he had won them over. But no, this was just one more shit test. I looked very slowly at both of them, and then took a chance. "Bullshit," I said, smiling. "I bet a lot of guys believe you, but I'm a very intuitive person. When I look at you both, I can tell you're very different. Too different." The 10 broke into a guilty smile. "We never tell anyone this," she said, "but you're right. We're just friends." Now I'd broken through her programming, moved her away from the autopilot responses she gives to men, and demonstrated that I was not just another guy. I took another chance, and I'd be willing to bet that you haven't even been friends for that long. Usually best friends start to have the same mannerisms, and you two don't really. "We've only known each other a year," the 10 admitted. Now it was time to back off my game and fluff a little. However, I made sure never to ask questions. Instead, as Juggler had taught me, I made open-ended statements that led them to ask me the questions. The 10 told me they were from San Diego, so we fluffed for a while about the West Coast and Miami. As we talked, I kept my back to the 11, as if I were less interested in her. This was classic mystery method. I wanted her thinking more about me, wondering why I wasn't giving her the attention she was so used to. Nothing in the game is an accident. I think of a woman's interest in me as a fire, and when it starts to die out, it's time to turn around and stoke it. So just when the 11 was about to walk away to find someone to talk to, I turned around and delivered a beautiful line. "You know what? When I look at you, I can see exactly what you looked like in middle school, and I'm willing to bet you weren't so outgoing or popular then." Sure, it was a truism, but she stared at me flabbergasted, wondering how I could possibly know that. To seal the victory, I laid out one last beauty-neutralizing, cold-reading routine. "I bet a lot of people think you're a bitch, but you're not. You're actually shy in a lot of ways." She began to give me the doggy dinner bowl look, as the Puas call it. It is the look that is the goal of any approach. Her eyes glazed over, her pupils dilated, and she just watched my lips move, entranced and attracted. I noticed, however, that the more interested the 11 became, the more kino the 10 gave me. Kino, in the Pua lexicon, being a word for touch. "You're interesting," the 10 gushed, pressing her breasts against me. I could see mystery, outbreak, and the matador of love rooting me on in the background. "We have to hang out with you in L.A. She leaned in and gave me a tight hug. "Hey, that'll be $30, I told her, disentangling myself. "This shit ain't for free." "The more you push them away, the more they run toward you." "I love him," she told her friend. Then she asked if she and her friend could stay with me next time they were in L.A. "Sure," I said, but as the words left my mouth, I realized, too late, that I should have made my hospitality more of a challenge. There's so much to remember and juggle during a pickup that it is hard to get everything perfect. But no matter. She gave me her phone number, and I gave her mine. You may have noticed that I haven't been referring to these girls by their names. That's because I never introduce myself during a pickup, As Mystery had taught me on that first workshop, I wait for the woman to introduce herself or ask for my name. That way, I know she's interested. So, as we exchanged numbers, I received my first IOIs and learned that the 10 was Rebecca and the 11 was Heather. Now it was time to separate the two of them and see if I could get enough IOIs to kiss-close Heather. A guy they knew suddenly showed up and bought 3 shots for Heather, Rebecca, and himself. I held out my empty hand and looked around, pretending to be hurt. Heather, who I was slowly realizing was actually a sweet girl beneath that laboriously wrought exterior, took the bait. "Don't mind him," she said, pointing to their guy friend. "He's just rude." As she called the bartender over and ordered me a shot, Rebecca threw her a dirty look. "Remember our rule?" she whined. I knew what their rule was. Girls like this love it when guys buy them drinks. But girls also don't respect guys who buy them drinks. A true pickup artist knows never to buy meals, drinks, or gifts for a girl he hasn't slept with. Dating is for tools. "We promised not to buy any drinks on this trip," Rebecca whined. "But you're not buying a drink for yourself," I told them. "You're buying one for me, and I'm different from all the other guys." I'm not really that arrogant, but in the game there are rules, and the rules must be obeyed because they work. Suddenly, Mystery walked toward me and whispered in my ear, "Isolate." "I want to show you something," I said to Heather as I took her by the hand. I led her to a nearby booth, sat her down, and performed the ESP experiment. Behind me, I saw Mystery punching his fist into his open hand in slow motion. It was a code, the signal to phase shift, to slow down and move in for the kill. I told her about soul gazing, and, with house music and dozens of conversations blaring around us, we stared into each other's eyes and shared a moment together. In my head, I imagined her as the pudgy middle school student she used to be. If I'd been thinking about how beautiful she really was, I would have been too nervous to sully her with my lips, as I was about to attempt to do. I slowly moved my head toward hers. "No lips," she said quietly. I held up my index finger, placed it against her lips, and said, "Shh." Then I kissed her on the lips. It would have been the most beautiful kiss of my life, but I was so lost in the seduction that I forgot I was wearing a fake lip ring. Worried that it would fall out, or even worse, end up on her lip, I pulled back, looked at her again, and then nibbled on her upper lip. Her tongue darted out of her mouth. "Hey, not so fast," I told her, as if she were the one hitting on me. The key to physical escalation, David D'Angelo had said in his seminar, is always 2 steps forward, 1 step back. We made out carefully, and then I returned her to Rebecca at the bar. I had a workshop to wing, so I told them both that it was a pleasure meeting them and I should rejoin my friends. We confirmed our plans to spend a weekend together, and I left with my heart singing. The Matador of Love was the first person to run up to me. He took my hand in his and kissed it. "In India, we put ourselves prostrate before people like you," he said, flapping his arms excitedly. "You've given me a new meaning on life. It was like watching John Elway do the 2-minute drive. You knew he had game before, but in that moment, he really proved it. You got the Super Bowl ring." For the rest of the night, I was on fire. Women who hadn't even seen me with the Platinum Non-Sisters were opening me. They could smell it. It didn't even matter whether I got laid or not, because this was the game artfully played. It was exactly what I'd been working so hard for. I just didn't realize that I'd ever be able to pull it off so smoothly, or that in the process, I was creating a hunger that could never be satiated. Chapter 3. When I came home from my travels with Mystery, Dustin was waiting in my apartment for me. The king of the naturals had returned. But what was he doing in my apartment? "Hi," he said in his soft, effeminate voice. He was wearing a tweed sport coat with large brown buttons, straight-legged polyester black slacks, and a black skull cap. I hadn't talked to Dustin in more than a year, since before I had joined the community. Last I'd heard, he was managing a nightclub in Russia. He had sent me photos of his girlfriends, one for each night of the week. He actually referred to them as Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and so on. "How'd you get in here?" "Your landlady, Louise, let me in. She's really a sweet person. Her son's a writer too, you know. He had a way of making people comfortable with him. "It's good to see you, by the way," he said as he gave me a big bear hug. When he pulled away, his eyes were misty, as if it really were good to see me again. The feeling was mutual. Dustin had been on my mind every day as I learned the pickup arts. Where Ross Jeffries needed spoken hypnotic patterns to convince a woman to explore her fantasies with him, Dustin was able to achieve the same result without uttering a word. He was a blank male canvas for a woman to project her repressed desires onto, even if she didn't consciously know what they were prior to meeting him. I never had the resources to understand how he operated before, but now, with my new knowledge, I could watch him work, ask questions, and eventually model his process. I could usher a whole new school of thought into the pickup community. "I don't know if I've told you what I've been doing the past year," I said, "but I've been hanging out with the world's greatest pickup artists. My whole life has changed. I get it now." "I know," he said. "Marco told me." He looked at me with big, wet, brown eyes, the ones that had gazed into the souls of countless beautiful women. "I don't," he paused. "I don't really do that anymore." I looked at him, incredulously at first, but then I noticed that the round black skullcap on his head was a yarmulke. "I live in Jerusalem now," he continued, "in a yeshiva. It's a religious school." "You're kidding." "No, I haven't had sex for 8 months. It's not allowed." I couldn't believe what I was hearing. The king of the naturals had gone celibate. It couldn't be true. Wasn't that why prisons were invented? They offered men food, clothing, shelter, television, and fresh air, but deprived them of the two things that really mattered, freedom and women. "Are you allowed to masturbate at least?" "No." "Really?" He paused. "Well, sometimes when I sleep, I have wet dreams." "See? God is trying to tell you something. It has to come out." He laughed and patted me on the back. His gestures were slow and his laugh condescending, as if he had spiritually bypassed toilet humor. "I go by my Hebrew name now," he said. "It was given to me by one of the highest rabbis at the yeshiva. It's Avisha." I was stunned. How could Dustin transform so suddenly from nightclub player to rabbinical student, especially now that I needed him most? "So what made you give up women?" I asked. "When you can get any girl you want, every guy, even if he's rich or famous, looks at you in a different way because you have something he doesn't," he said. "But after a while, I'd bring girls home and I didn't want to have sex with them anymore. I just wanted to talk. So we'd talk all night and bond on a very deep level, and then I'd walk them to the subway in the morning. That's when I started to leave it behind. I realized that I got my entire validation from women. Women became like gods to me, but false gods. So I went to find the real God." Sitting in his Moscow apartment, he said, he searched the internet for guidance, until he came across the Torah and started reading. After an eye-opening trip to Jerusalem, he returned to Russia and went to a casino party, where the mafia, corrupt businessmen, and materialistic hangers-on sickened him in comparison with the people he'd met in Israel. So he packed his bags, left his week's worth of girlfriends, and arrived in Jerusalem on the eve of Passover. "I stopped by," he said, "to ask your forgiveness for some of my past actions." I had no idea what he was talking about. He'd always been a great friend. "I idealized a lifestyle and behavior that were corrupt," he explained. "I abhorred kindness, mercy, human dignity, and intimacy. Instead, I used, degraded, and exploited women. I thought only about my pleasure. I despised the good instincts within me and within others, and attempted to corrupt anyone I met." As he spoke, I couldn't help thinking that all these things he was apologizing for were the very reasons I had befriended him in the first place. "I promoted and dragged you into this whole pickup thing as if what I was doing were the highest ideal a person could live for," he went on. "So, to whatever extent I am guilty of affecting the natural goodness of your soul, I am deeply sorry." It all made sense intellectually, but I've never trusted extremes, whether it be drug addiction, religious fanaticism, or zero-carb diets. There was something odd about Dustin, or Avisha. He had a hole he was trying to fill, first with women, now with religion. I listened to him but I had a different opinion. I accept your apology, I told him, but with a caveat that you have nothing to apologize for. He looked at me softly, but didn't say anything. I could see why he was so seductive. It was those eyes that glistened like the surface of a mountain lake, that intense power of focus, that way of making you believe that nothing else existed for him except what you were saying at that very moment. Think about it, I continued. If a guy wants to improve his odds of meeting women, he's going to have to make some changes to himself. And it just so happens that all the qualities women look for in guys are good things. I mean, I've become more confident. I started working out and eating healthier. I'm getting in touch with my emotions and learning more about spirituality. I've become a more fun, positive person. He looked at me, listening patiently. And I'm not just more successful with women now. I'm more successful in every other human interaction, from dealing with my landlord to handling credit card overcharges. Still looking. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm learning how to pick up women, sure, but in the process, I'm becoming a better human being. His mouth began to move. He was going to speak. Well, he said. Yes, what? I am eternally here for you as a true friend and also to make up for what I did. He wasn't convinced. Fuck him. I was going to take a nap. Mind if I stay over for a couple days? He asked. No problem, but I'm leaving for Australia on Wednesday. Do you have an alarm clock I can borrow? I need to pray with the sunrise. After I found him a small travel clock, he reached into his bag and pulled out a book. Here, he said. I brought this for you. It was a small hardcover edition of a 16th century book called The Path of the Just, with a note he had written for me, inscribed on the title page. It quoted the Talmud. Whoever destroys a single life is as guilty as though he had destroyed the entire world, and whoever rescues a single life earns as much merit as though he had rescued the entire world. So he was trying to save me. Why? I was having fun. Chapter 4. The day had arrived. This would be the most monumental trip of my seduction career. First, I was going to Toronto for a workshop Mystery was giving to Papa, a friend of Exotic Options from the Belgrade workshop. Papa was paying $1,500 for the privilege of hanging out one-on-one with Mystery and I. Afterward, Mystery wanted to get a tattoo with me, a heart on the wrist that would be the international symbol of Puas everywhere. Then we were going to take the bus to New York for Mystery's first classroom seminar, and finally, fly to Bucharest so that Mystery could implement what he called Project Bliss. He wanted to return to Eastern Europe, find two young bisexual women searching for a better life overseas, and seduce them. He planned to get them student visas, take them back to Canada, and train them to become strippers, girlfriends, and eventually, magic assistants. Tattoos and white slavery. That's where self-improvement had led me. On my way out of the house, I checked my mailbox. Along with the usual overdue bills and raised car insurance notices was a postcard of the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. Your Hebrew name is Tuvia, it said. The writing was Dustin's. It comes from the word Tav, or good. Its opposite is Ra, or evil. And in Hebrew, Tav also means that which endures, and Ra is that which is short-lived. So your essence is connected to a desire to search out and connect to that which endures, the good. But sometimes you get stuck at the bad along the way. On the flight, I reread the postcard. Dustin was trying to give me a message from God, and maybe he had a point. But, on the other hand, I'd had an enduring wish ever since adolescence for the power to seduce any woman I wanted. Now I was getting my wish. This was good. This was Tav. Mystery had recently gotten his own place in Toronto with a Pua named Number 9, a Korean computer geek who, thanks to Mystery's ever-present advice, had turned himself into a relatively cool-looking guy. They lived in a cramped two-bedroom apartment above a cyber cafe near the University of Toronto. Since Number 9 was out of town, I put my bags in his room and joined Mystery in the kitchen. Patricia had broken up with him, for good this time, and he'd been staying in his room a lot, playing a video game called Morrowind and downloading lesbian porn. Getting out of the house for these upcoming workshops would be good therapy for him. There were three types of people who signed up for the workshops. There were guys like Exotic Option from Belgrade, who were normal and well-adjusted socially, but wanted to have greater flexibility and choice in meeting girls. There were guys who were uptight and set in their ways, like Cliff of Cliff's List, who couldn't even handle having a nickname like everybody else. They tended to gather as much knowledge as they could, but had trouble making even the smallest behavioral change. And then there were people like Papa, approach machines who compensated for a lack of social skills with a lack of social fears. Approach machines tended to improve the fastest, simply by following the flowchart of material they were given. But once they ran out of material, they floundered. And this was going to be Papa's challenge. He was a soft-spoken Chinese pre-law student. He wore a checked button-down shirt and jeans that were a size too large. They always seemed to arrive in a checked button-down shirt and oversized jeans. And they always left in a loud shiny shirt, tight black synthetic pants, silver rings, and sunglasses pushed up on their heads. It was the player uniform, designed to convey sexuality, which was evidently synonymous with cheesiness. Mystery and I sat down with Papa at a cafe and asked the usual questions. What's your score? What would you like it to be? What are your sticking points? Well, I used to be the social chair of my fraternity, he began, and I come from a lot of money. My father is the president of a major university. Let me cut you off right there, I said. You're qualifying yourself to us. Instead of gaining our admiration, all you're doing is displaying lower status. A rich man doesn't have to tell you he's rich. Papa nodded stupidly. His head seemed to be surrounded by a dense invisible fog, which made his reaction time just a little slower than most people's. It gave the impression that he wasn't all there. Is it okay if I record everything you're saying? Papa asked, struggling to pull a small digital recorder out of his pocket. There are certain bad habits we've groomed our whole life, from personality flaws to fashion faux pas, and it has been the role of parents and friends, outside of some minor tweaking, to reinforce the belief that we're okay just as we are. But it's not enough to just be yourself. You have to be your best self. And that's a tall order if you haven't found your best self yet. That's why the workshops were so life-transforming. We told each student the first impression he made. We weren't afraid of hurting his feelings. We corrected his every gesture, phrase, and item of clothing, because we knew he wasn't living up to his potential. None of us is. We get stuck in old thought and behavior patterns that may have been effective when we were 12 months or 12 years old, but now only serve to hold us back. And while those around us may have no problem correcting our minor flaws, they let the big ones slide, because it would mean attacking who we are. But who are we, really? Just a bundle of good genes and bad genes, mixed with good habits and bad habits. And since there's no gene for coolness or confidence, then being uncool and unconfident are just bad habits, which can be changed with enough guidance and willpower. And that was Papa's asset, willpower. He was an only child, and used to taking any measure necessary to get what he wanted. I demonstrated some of my best routines on him, the jealous girlfriend opener, the best friends test, the cube, and a new piece I'd made up involving C-shaped smiles, U-shaped smiles, and the personality characteristics each conveyed. Papa recorded every word on his digital recorder. He would later transcribe them, memorize them, and ultimately use my exact words to pick up Paris Hilton. I should have recognized the signals then. I should have realized what was going on. This wasn't teaching. It was cloning. Mystery and I were traveling around the world making miniature versions of ourselves, and we would soon pay for it. Every piece of material we gave Papa, he used. Every error we pointed out, he corrected instantly. With each successful set, he seemed to grow an inch taller. Instead of summer school, he told me, he'd spent 3 months working on speed seduction skills. But until this workshop, he'd never seen real puas in the field before. On our last day with Papa, we went to a club called Government. I pushed him into sets and watched him repeat, like a robot, the openers, routines, and negs Mystery and I had taught him. And women were responding to him now. It was amazing how effective just a few simple lines could be, and it was also a little depressing. The first thing aspiring stand-up comics do is develop a tight 5-minute routine that can win over any audience. But after seeing hundreds of rooms fill with laughter on cue at the exact same points, they begin to lose respect for their audience for being so easily manipulated. Being a successful pickup artist meant risking the same side effect. When Papa left to get some sleep before his flight home, Mystery and I stayed at the club to continue sarging. Grimble had recently given me the idea of taking all the scraps of paper with phone numbers I'd collected and putting them under glass on a coffee table for decoration. But as I was sharing the idea with Mystery, he cut me off. "Proximity alert system," he announced. When women stand near a man, but facing away from him, especially when there's no real reason for them to be hanging out in that particular spot, it trips what Mystery calls the proximity alert system. It means they're interested. They want to be opened. Mystery wheeled around and started talking to a delicate blonde in a strapless dress and a muscular brunette in a do-rag. When he introduced me, he told him I was an amazing illusionist. We'd been winging together for months now, so I knew just what to do. Fake them out with a couple of the practical jokes and pseudo-magic tricks I'd learned in elementary school. In the field, one quickly learns that everything that was funny at age 10 is funny all over again. Mystery had brought along a video camera, so he began taping the interaction. The girls didn't seem to mind. As he isolated the brunette, I talked to the blonde. Her name was Caroline. Her friend was Carly. Caroline lived in the suburbs with her family. Her goal in life was to be a nurse, but she was currently working at Hooters, despite having breasts the size of sweet tarts and a shy, withdrawn personality. From 2 feet away, Caroline's face seemed alabaster. From 1 foot away, I noticed it was dappled with pinprick freckles. One of her teeth was crooked. She had a red mark on the skin over her collarbone, as if she'd been itching it. She smelled like cotton. She had gotten a manicure in the last 24 hours. She weighed no more than 100 pounds. Her favorite color was probably pink. I observed all these things as my mouth moved, reciting the routines I'd told to hundreds of girls before. What was different about Caroline was that the routines didn't seem to be working. I just couldn't reach what I call the hook point, which is when a woman you've approached decides she enjoys your company and doesn't want you to leave. Though I stood just a foot away from Caroline, a mile-wide chasm separated us. After watching the movie Boiler Room, about ruthless, cold-calling stockbrokers, Mystery had decided that phone numbers were wood. In other words, they were useless. Our new strategy was to no longer try to call a girl for a date, but to take her on a date right away, an instant date, to a nearby bar or restaurant. Changing venues quickly became a key piece in the pickup game. It created a sense of distorted time. If you went to three places with a group you'd just met, by the end of the night, it felt as if you'd all known each other forever. "Why don't we all grab a bite to eat?" Mystery suggested. We walked to a diner nearby, arm in arm with our instant dates. During the meal, everything suddenly clicked in the group. Carly felt comfortable enough to unleash her biting wit, and Caroline began to radiate empathy and warmth. We didn't need any routines or tactics. We all just made fun of ourselves and each other. Afterward, Carly invited us to call a cab from her apartment around the corner. She had just moved in, and the rooms were bare of furniture, so Mr. and I sat on the floor. We didn't call a cab, and the girls didn't remind us to, which we took as an IOI. Carly soon left the room with Mystery, giving Caroline tacit permission to fool around with me. As we wrapped ourselves around each other, the chasm that had separated us in the bar disappeared. Caroline's touch was soft and gentle, her body frail and forgiving. Now I understood why it had been so difficult to get rapport with her when we'd first met. She didn't communicate with words. She communicated with feelings. She'd make a great nurse. After Caroline brought in some blankets to make the hardwood floor a little more comfortable, I went down on her. I stacked her orgasms as Steve P. had taught me, until it seemed like her body was melting into the ground. But when I reached for a condom afterward, I heard the four words that had taken the place of "let's just be friends" in my life. "But I just met you." It was a much sweeter sound, and there was no reason to push for sex with Caroline. I knew I'd see her again. She lay on my shoulder, and we enjoyed the afterglow. She was 19, she said, and hadn't had sex in almost 2 years. The reason? She had a 1-year-old child at home. His name was Carter, and she was determined not to be another neglectful teenage mother. This was the first time she'd been apart from him for a weekend. When we awoke the next afternoon, awkward from the passion of the night before, Caroline suggested having breakfast at a restaurant next door. In the days that followed, I must have watched Mystery's video of that breakfast 100 times. At the diner the night before, Caroline's blue eyes were flat and distant. But at breakfast in the morning, they glittered and danced when she looked at me. Whenever I made a joke, even one that wasn't funny, a broad smile spread across her face. Something inside her heart had opened. It was, I realized, the first time I'd made a real emotional connection with a woman since I'd started picking them up. I don't have a particular type of girl I'm attracted to, the way some guys are Asian fetishists or Jessica Simpson fetishists. But of all the women in the world, the last type I ever thought I'd fall for would be a 19-year-old, single mom who waited tables at Hooters. But the great thing about the heart is that it has no master, despite what reason may think. When we returned home, Mystery and I loaded the footage of Carly and Caroline into Mystery's computer and proceeded to spend the next 6 hours self-indulgently editing it into a 6-minute video. When we finished, I called Caroline and she picked us up that evening. After dinner, we brought Carly and Caroline back to Mystery's house. As she watched the video, Caroline couldn't stop smiling. I brought her into Number 9's room afterward, and we lay on the bed and slowly undressed each other. Her body trembled with so much emotion that it seemed to dissipate beneath me. It felt like making love to a cloud. When she came, she didn't make a sound. As we lay together afterward, Caroline rolled away from me. She stared at the wall and grew distant. I knew what she was thinking. When I asked her about it, she burst into tears. "I gave it up too fast," she sobbed. "Now I'm never going to see you again." They were such sweet words because they were so honest. I slid my arm under her and placed her head on my shoulder. I told her, first of all, that every passionate relationship I've ever had began passionately. It was a line I'd learned from Mystery, but I did believe it. Second, I told her that maybe she shouldn't have, but she wanted to and needed to. It was a line I'd learned from Ross Jeffries, but I did believe it. Third, I told her that I was more mature than a lot of the people she'd been with before, so not to judge me by her past experiences. It was a line I'd learned from David D'Angelo, but I did believe it. Finally, I told her that I'd be sad if I never saw her again. It wasn't a line. When we finally emerged into the front room, we found Carly and Mystery wrapped around each other in a blanket. Caroline and I spooned on the couch next to them, and together we watched an episode of The Osbournes on Mystery's computer, each basking in our own post-coital glow. It was a beautiful moment, and it wouldn't last. Chapter 5. There is nothing more bonding than successfully picking up girls together. It is the basis for a great friendship. Because afterward, when the girls are gone, you can finally give each other the high five that you've been holding back since you met them. It is the sweetest high five in the world. It's not just the sound of skin hitting skin. It's the sound of brotherhood. "You know what's so fucked up?" Mystery said. "I feel so bad, and then a girl sleeps with me and likes me, and bam, I'm on top of the world again." Smack. "So?" Mystery asked. "So? Are you ready to commit to this lifestyle?" "I thought I was committed." "No, for life. It's in your blood now. You and me, we have to challenge each other. Of all the guys I've met, you're my only competition. No one else has the chance to reach the throne except you." When I was a teenager, I'd lie awake in bed, praying to God, "Please don't let me die before having sex. I just want to see what it feels like." But now, I had a different dream. At night, I'd lie in bed and ask God to just let me have the opportunity to be a father before I die. I've always lived for experience, traveling, learning new skills, meeting new people. But having a child is the ultimate experience. It's what we're here for. And despite my rakish behavior, I hadn't lost sight of that. Yet, at the same time, living for experiences also means wanting the novelty and adventure of dating different women. I can't imagine ever choosing one person for life. It's not that I'm scared of commitment. It's that I'm scared of arguing with someone I love over whose turn it is to do the dishes, of losing the desire to have sex with a woman lying next to me every night, of taking a back seat in her heart to our children, of resenting someone for limiting my freedom to be selfish. This pickup thing had never been about sowing my wild oats. My oats are always going to be wild, and that's not necessarily something I relish. I'm screwing up my chances of being a cool dad. If I'd married my first girlfriend and had kids with her, they'd be, say, 8 and 10 now. And I'd be an excellent father, able to relate to them on nearly every level. But it's too late for me now. By the time my kids are 10, I'll be well into my 40s. I'll be so out of touch, they'll make fun of my taste in music and beat me at arm wrestling. And now, I was really going to screw up my chances of getting married. I was about to brand myself a player for life. An hour later, Mystery and I were outside Fine Line Tattoo on Kingston Road. I was smarter than this, I thought. But it's easy to get caught up in the moment, in the hand slap, in the brotherhood. I turned the handle of the door and pushed. It didn't open. Though it was 3 o'clock on a Monday afternoon, the shop was closed. "Damn," Mystery said. "Let's find somewhere else." I'm not a superstitious person, but when I'm on the fence about an idea, it only takes a slight draft to push me in either direction. "I can't go through with this," I said. "What's wrong?" "I have problems with commitment. I don't think I can even commit to a tattoo that signifies a lack of commitment." My neurotic nature had saved me for once. The next night, Caroline drove to Mystery's house, and we all went out for sushi. "Where's Carly?" Mystery asked. Caroline flushed and looked into her tea. "She, couldn't make it," she said. "She says hi, though." I could see Mystery's body language change. He slumped in his chair and pressed further. "Did she say why? Is there a problem?" "Well," Caroline said, she's with her boyfriend." Mystery's face went pale. "And she wouldn't come? Carly said you and she were very different anyway." Mystery went quiet. He didn't speak for another 10 minutes. Whenever we asked a question to draw him out, he responded monosyllabically. It wasn't that he loved Carly. He just hated rejection. He was experiencing the downside of seducing a woman with a boyfriend. She usually went back to him afterward. And seeing Caroline and I enjoying each other's company so much only rubbed it in. "I'm the world's greatest pickup artist," he grumbled in my direction. "How come I don't have a girlfriend?" "Well, maybe because you're the world's greatest pickup artist." After a long period of silence, Mystery asked Caroline to drive him to the strip club where his ex-girlfriend Patricia worked. She dropped him off in the parking lot and then took me to spend the night at the house in the suburbs where she lived with her mother, sister, and brother. It would be my first time meeting her family. Her mother greeted us at the door. In her arms was a crying baby, my teenage girlfriend's baby. "Do you want to hold him?" Caroline asked. I suppose the stereotypical reaction would be to say that I was scared, that reality sunk in, that I wanted to get out of there. But I didn't. I wanted to hold him. It was kind of cool. This was what I got into the game for. To have these kinds of adventures. To hold a baby in my arms for the first time and wonder, what does his mother expect of me? Chapter 6. While I was playing daddy with Caroline, Mystery was spiraling. Dropping him off at the strip club was a bad move. Seeing Patricia had fucked him up. Not only would she not take him back, but she also told him that she'd started dating other people. "She's been working out 3 hours a day," he said over the phone. "She lost 15 pounds, and her ass is a 10, dude. The things a chick will do when she's angry. Damn." "Don't think about how good she looks," I advised. "Look for the flaws and blow those up in your mind. It'll make it easier. I know that intellectually, but emotionally I'm fucked up. I feel like I'm being raked over coals. It all came crashing down on me when I saw her again. That hot body, the tan lines. She was the hottest stripper in the place. And I can't have her. Carly's back with her boyfriend, and I'm beat from trying to make my new place livable. For what?" "Dude, you're a pickup artist. There are hundreds more just like Patricia out there, and you can get them in a night." "I'm not a pickup artist. I'm a lover. I love women. I swear, I don't even think about threesomes anymore. I would be so happy to settle for Patricia now. I've got Patricia withdrawal on the mind. I miss her every minute of the day." Mystery had hardly thought about Patricia or talked about her until she rejected him. Now he was obsessed. His own theories on attraction had come back to slap him in the face. Patricia was doing a takeaway. But for her, it wasn't a technique. It was for real. As a magician used to exploiting the gullibility of others, Mystery had no patience with anything spiritual or supernatural. His religion was Darwin. Love to him was simply an evolutionary impulse that enabled human beings to fulfill their two primary objectives, to survive and replicate. He called that impulse pair bonding. "It's strange how strong pair bonding is," he said. "I feel so alone now. I'll tell you what, we'll pick you up tomorrow and you can play in the suburbs with us. It'll cheer you up." Caroline and I put Carter in his stroller and pushed him around the block to a park. As I sat down on the bench, I thought about what a pathetic couple of pickup artists Mystery and I were. Kids around the world thought we were in hot tubs, surrounded by bikini-clad models. Instead, he was alone in his apartment, probably crying and watching lesbian porn, and I was in the suburbs, pushing a baby around in a stroller. In the morning, Caroline and I fetched Mystery from the city. He hadn't shaved since I'd last seen him, and thin patches of stubble dappled his baby white skin. He wore a gray t-shirt that hung loosely over faded jeans. "Just make sure your family doesn't ask me to do any magic tricks for them," he told Caroline. Yet, that night, when Caroline's mother asked him what he did for work, Mystery launched into a spectacular performance. He introduced each illusion, mind-reading, bottle levitating, self-levitating, sleights of hand, with 10 minutes of patter and panache that put every other illusionist I'd seen to shame. He charmed everyone in the room. Caroline's mom was flabbergasted. Her younger sister was attracted, and her brother wanted to learn how to levitate chalk to freak out his teachers. In that moment, I realized that Mystery actually had the skills to achieve his dream of being a superstar daredevil illusionist. After Caroline's family turned in for the night, Mystery asked her if she had any sleeping pills. "All we have is Tylenol number 3, which has codeine," Caroline told him. "That'll work," Mystery said. "Just give me the whole bottle. I have a high tolerance." Chapter 7. The next morning, Mystery lay slumped in the back seat of Caroline's car, wrapped in a blanket and shrouded by a hat pulled low over his eyes, still apparently knocked out from the 4 Tylenol he'd swallowed the night before. Beyond asking us to drop him off at his family's condo, he didn't say a word, which was rare for him. We parked and took the elevator to his sister's apartment on the 20th floor. It was a cluttered 2-bedroom hovel crammed with people. Mystery's mother, a Zoftig German woman, sat on a beat-up flower-patterned sofa chair. His sister, Martina, her 2 children, and her husband, Gary, were crammed into a couch next to her. Mystery's father was shut up in his apartment, 4 floors above them, sick with liver disease from a lifetime of drinking. "Hey, how come you don't have a girl with you?" Mystery's 13-year-old niece, Shaolin, chided him. She knew all about his girls. He often used his nieces as a routine to convey his vulnerable paternal side to women. He truly loved his nieces and seemed to come back to life a little when he saw them. Mystery's brother-in-law, Gary, played us some pop ballads he had composed. The best of these was a song called Casanova's Child, which Mystery sang along with at a near-deafening volume. He seemed to identify with the title character. Being at home was slightly awkward for Mystery. His father, he had often told me in the past, was an alcoholic German immigrant who verbally and physically abused him and his mother. His brother, who was 14 years older than him, was gay. And his mother blamed herself for smothering his brother with love to make up for her husband's abuse. So, to compensate, she was emotionally distant from Mystery. When he was still a virgin, at age 21, he began to worry that maybe he was gay. So, in a bout of depression, he began formulating what would become the Mystery Method, dedicating his life to pursuing the love he never received from his parents. Caroline and I left his house after another half hour. The girls chased us all the way to the elevator bank, laughing and screaming, followed by Mystery. Suddenly, a door swung open, and a man in a clerical collar gave the girls a steely, condescending stare. "You shouldn't be making so much noise in the hallway," he said. Mystery turned crimson. "What are you going to do about it?" he asked. "Because I think we should. These are young girls. They're having fun." "Well," the reverend said, "they can have fun in a place where they're not disturbing other residents." "I'll tell you what," Mystery snapped. "I'm going to get a knife, and we'll find out just who exactly should be in the hall when I get back. Mystery marched back to the house as the rest of us exchanged concerned looks. The Reverend slammed the door shut, and Caroline and I slipped away in the confusion. I didn't really want to go back to Caroline's. I've lived in cities my whole life. I hate the suburbs. My biggest fear is being bored or boring. Weekend nights weren't made for sitting around watching videos from Blockbuster. But Caroline couldn't stay in Toronto. She didn't want to be away from her son. She didn't want to be a typical teenage mother. So while Caroline played with Carter the next day, I checked my email. Mystery and I had posted a field report about Carly and Caroline a few days earlier, and my inbox was full with messages from kids I didn't know from North Carolina, Poland, Brazil, Croatia, New Zealand, and beyond. They were looking to me for help, just as I had once looked to Mystery. There were also two emails from Mystery. In the first, he wrote that he'd gotten into a fight with his sister over the hallway incident. She proceeded to punch me several times. I had to restrain her by grabbing her throat and flipping her to the ground. I then left to go back to my house. I wasn't angry. I just wanted to stop her from attacking me. Weird, huh? The second one read simply, "I'm cracking up. I'm hungry, my head hurts, my skin aches, and I've been choking it all day to internet porn. I'm going to get sleeping pills because if I stay up all night alone, I'll go nuts. I can't wait to disappear. I'm so close to saying fuck it and ending it all. This living thing isn't fun anymore." He was losing his mind, and I was stuck in Bumblefuck, Ontario, watching Britney Spears and Crossroads with three teenagers, one of whom was supposedly now my girlfriend. The next morning, I had Caroline drive me to Mystery's place. "Can you stay with me?" I asked. "I should really get back to Carter," she said. "I haven't been paying enough attention to him, and I don't want my mom to think I'm being neglectful. Your mom wants you to go out and be with your friends. You're putting this pressure on yourself." She agreed to come inside for an hour. We walked upstairs to Mystery's apartment and opened the door. He was sitting on his bed, watching Steven Spielberg's AI on his computer. He was wearing the same gray t-shirt and jeans I had last seen him in. There were scratches on his arms from his fight with his sister. He turned to me and began to speak. His voice was cold and dispassionate. "I've been thinking," he said. "The robots in this movie have motivated self-interest. They set objectives and then work to accomplish them. The child robot seeks protection and is mommy. The sex robot chases women. When he's freed from a cage, he sets out to mate with real women again because that's his objective." "Okay." I leaned against a computer desk, pushed flush against his bed. The room was the size of a large closet. The walls were bare. "What's your point?" "The point is," he said, in the same deadened voice, "what is my objective? And what is yours? I'm a child robot, a sex robot, and an entertainer robot." On the floor in front of his bed was a half-eaten plate of uncooked spaghetti. Shrapnel from the spaghetti sticks was scattered around the room. Nearby were the remnants of a black cordless phone that had been smashed against the floor. The battery dangled helplessly out of the open back. "What happened?" I asked. "I blew up at my sister and my mom. They wouldn't shut up." When Mystery, or any Pua, was in a funk, there was only one cure for it. To go out sarging and meet new options. "Let's get peacocked and go to a strip club tonight," I suggested. Strip clubs were Mystery's weakness. He had a list of strip club rules that pretty much guaranteed him at least a phone number every time. Among them, befriend the DJ, never pay for a dance or a drink, do not hit on, compliment, or touch a stripper, stick to your material, and change the subject whenever a stripper starts reciting the stories she tells every other guy. "I don't want to go out," he said. "There's no point." He stopped the movie on his computer and began working on a half-finished email. "What are you doing?" I asked. "I'm emailing the students in New York and telling them the seminar's canceled." He spoke as if he were on autopilot. "Why are you doing that?" I was pissed. I'd put a month of my life on hold so we could go to New York and Bucharest together. I'd already bought the plane tickets. And now, because of some mixture of Steven Spielberg and codeine after effects, he was bailing out. "Not enough people. Oh well." Come on, I said. You're already making $1,800, and I'm sure more guys will sign up at the last minute. It's New York, for Christ's sake. No one commits to anything in advance. Living, he sighed, costs too much. It was all too melodramatic for me. The guy was a black hole sucking up attention. Fuck him. You're so fucking selfish, I seethed. What about our tickets to Bucharest? You can go if you want. I'm canceling all shows, all agents, all seminars, all workshops, all trips. I'm stopping everything. I don't want to be known for being a Ross Jeffries. I gave his dresser a mule kick from behind. I have a long fuse, but when it hits bottom, I explode. Though my father may not have taught me much about women, he did teach me that. An orange prescription bottle hit the floor, scattering pills. I picked it up and looked at it. The word Rivotril was on the label. What are these? They're my sister's antidepressant medication. They really aren't about dealing with depression so much as making me sleep. Cold. Clinical. I figured they couldn't be doing much good, so I left 3 in the bottle and stuffed the rest in my pocket. I didn't want him overdosing. Mystery logged on to Party Poker, an online game.